I had originally intended to spend quite a lot of time in this showing how some technical aspects of this problem address Beck's Risk Society, but I think you've done that much better, Keith, and talking to Frank yesterday as well, I have a lot of ignorance about that. So I'm going to focus largely on the technical aspects of risk assessment in relation to this arsenic problem. But I do have three, just one theme that goes through this, and that is in order to be able to solve problems like this, there are three major elements. One, we need to have the technical competence, the technical understanding of the problem and its solution. I think secondly, we need to have the knowledge and perception in all kinds of people, whether it's local people or people in government. But those two alone are not sufficient. We also need the motivation of people who have the authority and the power to do things about it. And all those three things are necessary for a solution. But as I said, most of what I'm going to talk about is looking at the first aspect of that, is the technical knowledge. Which one of these do we use? I should thank, before I go on, much of the work that I talk about is part of funded by a British Council collaboration with our partners, Indian Institute of Chemical Biology in India. And a lot of the risk assessment work that I'm going to present, most of the data was done by a very good PhD student, Deborah Priya Mondal, who's actually back in Calcutta at the moment, having finished her PhD, and also all these people. So it's a lot of work in there. So for introduction, obviously it's a global problem. This is largely based on the map that Peter Ravenscroft, Hugh Brammer and Keith Richards have in their book, but also with some additional points. Indonesia, Lenny Winkle has done some very good work in there, extending the distribution. We know that it's Bangladesh is the country most seriously impacted by it. And as Keith has mentioned, we have the national regulatory limit of 50 ppb, the WHO limit of 10 ppb, and the hot colours, I'm sorry, the scale is very small, but basically the hot colours are showing where people are exposed to greater than the regulatory limit. Most of the arsenic occurs at relatively shallow depths, and the unfortunate social implication of that is that's the depths that people typically can afford to drill to. So it, if you like, it compounds the problem. Another important technical aspect of the problem is that much of the arsenic in the water is in the form of inorganic arsenic, arsenic 3, arsenic 5, and they are much more toxic than other forms of arsenic. In fact, these forms of arsenic, their toxicity is very similar to that of DDT, whereas, for example, some of the, say, methylated species, which are much less abundant, their toxicities are more like that of ethanol. One thing I did want to emphasise that's a little bit different is that the kind of health outcomes, detrimental health outcomes arising from exposure, chronic exposure to low-level arsenic, are extremely varied. The one that Keith was talking about, keratoses and hyperpigmentation, is probably the most obvious, the most visible manifestation of detrimental health impact. We know that it has very high prevalence. It's also extremely visible as well. And we've got a pretty good idea about dose-response relationships, how much arsenic you get in through your water, how likely you are to develop these things. But there are a lot of other health impacts that are perhaps even more important, but much less visible and much less known about. So Keith, for example, mentioned cancers, skin cancers and lung cancer in particular are perhaps one of the most serious health outcomes. There's a lot of good dose response data on that, but there are other things like ischemic heart disease, diabetes. These are things that are very widespread in the population, and from an epidemiological point of view, it is very difficult to pinpoint and say this particular person had a heart attack because of exposure to arsenic. So it's a massive problem that is very relevant to us here in the West, because I think we look at how much we're exposed to here and kind of assume that it's not a problem for us. This is somebody else's problem. This is a Bangladesh problem. And I'm not entirely sure that that is the case. I'm a geochemist, and when I first started looking into the risk side of things, the thing that amazed me the most about this situation, given how serious it is that people didn't actually even know how many people have arsenicosis in Bangladesh. This is a meta-analysis by Winston Yu. This is just a figure taken from his data. And it's just showing it's a pretty basic piece of data. This is the prevalence of arsenicosis predicted in Bangladesh as a function of the size of study. And what's clear, apart from the fact, I mean, they're so disparate, it's on a log scale, there are two kind of populations of studies here. There is one bunch of populations up here which estimate prevalences between 10%, it sounds a bit high to me, and 100%, which is obviously nonsense. And all of these studies up here suffer from the problem that people have deliberately gone into areas where they know that arsenic poisoning is a problem, and they've extrapolated from their extremely biased sampling to the whole of Bangladesh. So these people may be not necessarily doing it, but these estimates have been used previously to estimate the level of arsenicosis or the prevalence of it. So there's extreme bias in there. And then down for these ones, these are much larger studies. And as from with the new report, that these are probably underestimates of the prevalence of arsenicosis. And there are many good reasons for it. One is that many of the symptoms are similar to other diseases, so it's maybe difficult to diagnose. But Keith, then, his talk mentioned also that there are kind of institutional reactions to a problem. And I've certainly come across instances where there's been pressure on people doing work, not necessarily in Bangladesh, because I've never worked there, but in other countries, where there's pressure to underreport for whatever reason. So there's the basic point about this. This is maybe the best estimate of the prevalence of arsenicosis, about 1% or so of the population. But there's a huge amount of uncertainty in even basic data. Here are some slides actually presented at the meeting that Peter and Keith and Hugh organised at IGS a few years ago, just to illustrate that exposure to arsenic causes a massive increase in the risk of lung cancer. This is from Alan Smith from Berkeley. And maybe to put it in a form that's more communicable, again, this is Alan Smith's slide. At 500 ppb, something like 10% of people will die from lung cancer as a result of chronic exposure. At 50 ppb, the Bangladesh level, you're looking at about 1%. That's kind of comparable to being married or a child of an active smoker. But even more worrying, I think, is the 10 ppb level that's widely used by the WHO. Even then, 1 in 500, I don't know how comfortable you are with having a 1 in 500 chance of dying from lung cancer from drinking water that, it's not a recreational activity. So even at 10 ppb, there are serious concerns about how important it is. I'll flick through that. Time's gone on. Keith has already shown this. I'm just reiterating that it is a problem that manifests itself not just at the time, but 20 or 30 years later. And again, reiterating just an idea that in Chile, at this exposed population, it's of the order of 10% of all deaths were attributable to chronic exposure to arsenic. Now, one thing that I want to show that is maybe different from what Keith was saying, and that is I want to highlight this point about the difference, the health effects, the visible health effects and the non-visible health effects. So this is work that our colleagues in ICB have been doing. And it's basically looking at genetic damage that is induced in people who are exposed to arsenic. And what they've done is they've looked at basically micronuclei damage in a whole variety of different types of cells. All these three different blocks show the same thing in different cell types. These are urothelial cells taken from urine. And so basically the higher these graphs are, the more genetic damage there is. And the three groups are, these are people who are not exposed. They have very low levels of micronuclei damage. This group up here, these people have been exposed to, I think, around 300 ppb of arsenic. They have, not surprisingly, very large degrees of genetic damage. But the one that's most interesting to me is this group here. This group here, they've been exposed to very high levels of arsenic in their water supply, but they have no visible manifestations of arsenic-induced diseases. They don't have keratoses, they don't have hyperpigmentation. You look at these guys, there's apparently nothing wrong with them. Nevertheless, these guys, it's somewhat less, but they also have very, very elevated levels of genetic damage induced by exposure to arsenic. So there's a time bomb, if you like, of a large number of people that we do not see. They don't have visible manifestations of the disease, but nevertheless they have genetic damage that is a precursor to development of cancer. So, a very long introduction. But there are massive health risks. There's very poor quantification, even now, even though we've known the problem for a long time. Many visibly asymptomatic people are still at risk. And as Keith mentioned, there's future risks arising from historical exposure. So this is one of the reasons we put together a probabilistic risk assessment models for this, and we're kind of in the process of doing it. And this is a standard way of doing it, assessing what the hazard is, looking at human exposure, and then incorporating dose-response relationships that are published in the literature to estimate overall risks. And we have a model that I won't go into the details, but basically we can estimate deaths and also DALYs as a result of that. And we've also just started working with a hydroeconomist at Manchester, Johanna Sau, on looking at QALYs as well, to economic impacts. Time's probably getting very short, so we do a variety of means. This is actually Cambodia. This is Bengal, using geostatistical methods to map out the distribution of arsenic in the groundwaters. This is the much smaller area chapter, which is just north of Calcutta. As I mentioned, the other things we're looking at is exposure routes through drinking water, through rice, and also the cooking of rice. So this is the kind of data that we get. We look at arsenic in drinking water in exposed individuals, arsenic in raw rice. The form of arsenic in rice makes a big difference, so we measure that, and arsenic in cooked rice, which is different from that in market rice. And so for this particular area in West Bengal, this is a result we get, which we think is a very significant one. Most of the remediation of arsenic in West Bengal and most other places where it's going on is focused on drinking water. And what this diagram shows is that in this area, actually about half or nearly half of the exposure to rice is not through water at all, it's through rice. And all the money they're spending, $500 million in West Bengal, on improving their water supply, which is a very good thing to do. But if they don't do something about their exposure through rice, then that's a major exposure route that isn't going to be eliminated. And that's just showing three different areas where these grey ones are showing cancer risks arising from rice ingestion. This thing here, the reference dose, is basically what you'd be exposed to at the regulatory limit. Okay, so that's one of our major conclusions. People in Bangladesh are not the only people in the world who eat rice. In fact, rice is commonly, lots of us eat rice. There are particular communities within the UK that also eat rice as well. Our rice comes from many parts of the country. And one of the things that follows on from what we're looking at here is that food regulations for arsenic content, particularly in rice, need to be looked at. And if it sounds crazy to you, only 3 months ago or 4 months ago, the European Food Standards Authority came out with a scientific comment to say exactly that. We have arsenic in food regulations in the UK that are based on this incident, the arsenic, the so-called Manchester beer epidemic from over 100 years ago, that set the level at around 1 ppm. And if you compare that to the exposure that we'd get from the regulatory limits from water, well, if we wanted the rice regulatory limits to be the same, it wouldn't be 1 ppm or 1,000 ppb, it would be down here somewhere, depending on how much rice people eat. So there's nearly an order of magnitude problem in that regulatory level, which I hope people will be systematically looking at. Okay, there are lots of uncertainties in this work, and as for, I think you're probably not interested in the details of what kind of parameter uncertainties and some of the model uncertainties are. But one thing that I did particularly want to look at, how much time have I done to?
We've got
13
minutes.
Oh, 7 minutes.
7 minutes.
Maybe I shouldn't flip through that so much. My role as a geochemist has been very much looking at this aspect of it, secular changes in hazard. As Keith has mentioned, this is a natural problem. The arsenic that occurs in the groundwaters in Bangladesh and other parts of the world, it was there before we were. So we are not the people who've created it. It's an environmental risk. But one idea that is arising at the moment is that human activities at the moment are serving to change it. And there are two ways in which that is happening. One is that large amounts of arsenic-bearing groundwaters are used to irrigate rice paddy fields. And up until recently, it's been very unclear whether that has resulted in a net increase of arsenic in rice paddy soils. Basically, during the dry season, you have these arsenic-rich waters that are put down on the fields. In the wet season, quite often it's flushed away by the monsoons. So who knows whether that completely removes it or not. So in these are papers in Environmental Science and Technology, and there's a more recent paper by Linda Roberts in Nature Geoscience last year, which is showing for the first time that there are actually secular increases in the arsenic content of soils in rice paddy fields in Bangladesh, which is not going to cause a massive problem in the next month or the next year, but over a period of decades is slowly going to alienate soils. Then the other one, this is much more contentious, I'd say. This is Charlie Harvey's idea from MIT from about 8 years ago, who is saying that irrigation pumping will also lead to a secular increase in groundwater arsenic. And again, it's a complex technical argument, but it's something that there's a lot of discussion in the geochemical community on at the moment, and it's something that I think has not yet been resolved yet. Again, if it's correct, the time scale over which that will happen is probably decades or 100 years or so. Okay, the last thing that I wanted to talk about on the technical side of things was risk substitution. And that's one of the most evident things about the installation of all these wells in Bangladesh and elsewhere is that people have been focused on one particular risk and remediating that risk and not considering other ones. So one thing that we're particularly interested in looking at is, given that all these wells were installed to remediate risks from pathogens, waterborne pathogens, well, what are the relative balance of the risks from those two things? A couple of years ago, in environmental health perspectives, a guy called Lukubi, or a group from Australia, who put forward this notion that if you mitigate arsenic-bearing wells and replace it with, or go back to, if you like, unimproved water supplies, then you have this trade-off between dallies that are ascribable to the arsenic in the groundwater. So if you replace it, you get rid of this lot. But if you have pathogens in the water supply, then you have, irrespective of the arsenic concentration, you have some kind of fixed negative health impacts arising from that. But implicit in their discussion was basically there is a crossover point. For very high arsenic concentration in the wells, it makes sense to do this, but for very low arsenic concentrations, you're actually opening yourself up to having higher risks from waterborne pathogens. And I just put that in to show, obviously, that all kinds of factors determine where this crossover point can be. Rather in support of it, from DFID, Guy Howard, from your DFID over here, using measurements of pathogens in waters in Bangladesh from a variety of different remediation options, was comparing the dallies, the negative health effects due to microbes, the negative health effects due to arsenic. And the one thing that is really, you know, even though the scale is very small, this is 1,000 microdallies here. This is 1,000 microdallies up here. And that's firmly showing that the risk from the pathogens far outweighs the risk from the arsenic. So that's one view. But an alternative view, and one that's quite long-standing, is a lovely study by Esri back in the early 1990s. And So maybe a very good example of maybe social, cultural experience isn't adequate to actually find the right answer to something. Because the conclusion that he came up with was that water quality doesn't impact people's health significantly in these developing countries. It doesn't do it at all. What impacts people's health is level of sanitation, hygiene practices, education. That's far more important. So one of the things we've actually gone out to test is, well, his study was over 7 continents, I think a huge number of different areas, and maybe the fact he didn't find a relationship between health impacts and quality of water was because he had just such a heterogeneous group. So we've actually looked at it's a very small study in West Bengal, but we're just looking at, these are thermally tolerant coliforms, which are a proxy, if you like, for pathogens in groundwater. This is what people drink, and this is the water that's supplied to them. And if you're thinking you can't possibly put a straight line through that, well, it's correct, you can't put a straight line through it. It's basically saying that the quality of the water source is completely non-predictive of the quality of water that people are drinking. And the reason for that is because water is not the only source of getting pathogens, particularly for looking at fecal-derived pathogens in humans. We can spend an awful lot of money making sure that we don't get excreta into groundwaters or surface waters, wherever we get it from. But there are a lot of alternative routes for these pathogens to humans, much of which is going on within the household itself. So again, it's been pointed out that over the decades that all these tube wells have been put in Bangladesh, it has at the same time been associated, well, at the same time, let me not use the word associated, at the same time we've seen, sorry, I'll go back, there's been an increase in life expectancy, largely driven by decreasing mortality in Bangladesh. And there is an assumption that this is because it's of all these tube wells put in. Well, at the risk of putting in a rather facile example, at the same time, I'm Australian, Shane Warne's my cricketing hero, so why not put him in? But we've had increased life expectancy in Australia. We've also seen a very substantial decrease in infant mortality. But I would defy anybody here to say that that decrease in infant mortality in Australia is due to the installation of tube wells in Bangladesh. So I think there's a major problem in terms of not having sufficient technical, assuming there's a, yes, there's a not having sufficient technical expertise to answer the question. So I'll wind up very quickly. Having said that, if I can just quote, this is from Tagore Rabindranath, who's the Bengali National Nobel Prize winner from nearly 100 years ago now. And this guy, Babuji, Babuji the engineer in this thing, the waterfall. And it says a lot about technocratic solutions, whether the technocratic solution is installing a well. This guy in this novel, his lifetime aim was to build a dam. That's all he wanted to do. And when it was pointed out to him that loads of farmers were starving downstream, it's like, well, what do I care? I've achieved my lifetime ambition of building a dam. That's what I wanted to do. So I'll risk up very quickly. Can I just finish on more, some of these things on risk perception? Sometimes it's ideas are common sense, they're not necessarily correct. It was pointed out very correctly, I think, that back in the early 1980s, there was a lot of ignorance about arsenic. It was just complete, it wasn't on the agenda. So fair enough, maybe that is a justification for doing it, maybe not. But as a figure that's even scarier now, these are the status of wells installed in one area of Bangladesh. This is work of Lex Van Heen at Columbia. And the most damning thing about all this is wells installed since between 20,000 and 2005. Like, most of these wells still have really high arsenic in it. I mean, can you tell us that people are not aware now that there's an arsenic problem in Bangladesh? Wow. So let me stop there. That's probably a good place to stop. There are all kinds of things. Maybe I'll just finish with this thing. Say that we have arsenic generated by new, or the hazard is generated by new technology. Clearly, incomplete risk analysis has been carried out. But the responsibilities for the implementation of this are very complex. I think Peter is going to talk about the legal action related to that, but also that it has very detrimental implications for effective remediation because of the lack of clarity about where this needs to be solved. Okay, sorry to interrupt.
Thank you very much.